All set? All right. Good morning, everybody. I'll call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for this Tuesday, October 24th, 2017. And ask if everybody please join the Board as we honor America with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you again. Good morning. First item is public comment number one. It's an opportunity for members of the public to comment on items on today's agenda. Anybody wishing to do so, come right on up to the microphone. And seeing no one moving to the microphone, I don't see John Pieper here at this point. So, Lord, if it's okay, we'll just move on. And when he gets here, we'll get our update from him. So, agency reports first is VA. Brett and Pat, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Right, we're better than we deserve, actually.
Have you been listening to Dave Ramsey?
Yes, I have. He does say that at times, too, doesn't he?
Yeah, I guess I'm not. Sure.
All right. Okay. Well, let me just start out. Or, Pat, do you want to start out?
Oh, okay, I could. Last week we attended the State Commissioner and Directors meeting down at Des Moines. All the present sitting commissioners were in attendance. Both Brett as a director and Aaron as our VSO were both there. The nice thing about it is when they went through and did a list of all the counties that were there and how many were in attendance, and Story County had the largest contingent of people there, so we did the county well.
Outstanding.
Yeah. Thank you for letting us all attend that. And before I start, just a couple of things just to bring up, just to kind of get this information out to our veterans. Let me go back to December 26, 2015, okay? A veteran came in by the name of Jeffrey J. Starnes from Codal. Some of you may know him. And he was telling me when he got out June 29, 1973, that there was a medal that he didn't get. It's called an Army Commendation Medal. You know. So we started the process. And you might have seen him October the 10th on KCCI receiving his medal of Army Commendation Medal from Senator Grassley. But what we didn't know, there was a Valor's, if I'm pronouncing that right, Valor's Unit Ribbon. He didn't ask for, but in the whole process we found out that he should have received these also when he discharged in 1973. So I urge all veterans to, you know, take a look at that. And I don't know why it took this long, but just one day sit down and looked at his discharge and noticed it was missing. So sometimes that's all it takes. And from time to time, we've done that with World War II veterans, Korea veterans. A lot of times the kids will ask questions about it, and we'll look into it. And Dave Allen he works for Senator Grassley, so I got a good personal relationship with him. And we come up and do these medals. But on this one here, Senator Grassley did several. But so we're catching up with him. Sorry it's taking this long. Also, I wanted to mention at this school that we went to last week, they have a what they call a PID card, and that stands for Personal Identity Verification. And so I'm working to get this card. And what it will do for our veterans is they can come into the office and I'll have to log onto the computer with this card. And I could look at everything the VA is looking at on their claim. So for an example, a veteran comes in and he just doesn't remember what he filed for in the past, or what he's getting now, or why he's even, why he's getting what he's getting now. And so with this card, we'll be able to provide that service once I get it. So let's just let you know about that. All right, greetings from all the commissioners during the last quarter. We assisted five veterans just for county benefits. The total assistance there was $1,689.20. The breakdown was came in for rent assistance, $1,435. One veteran came in for utilities, $54.20. And one veteran came in for dental assistance, $200. I think we got a pretty good break on the dental assistance, right?
Yeah.
$200. During the quarter, however, we did visit with 273 veterans and surviving spouses for eligibility for federal VA benefits.
I have a question for you, okay? Because when you list everybody breaking it out, I come up with 283 that I come up with a $10 or a 10-person difference. Is that just math?
Yeah, it's just. I guess 5 out of 4 people are bad at math.
Well, I would be one. That was good. Yeah, it was a journal. You know, sorry.
Yeah, I thought you were wrong.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Okay, so
I don't
know where. Yeah. Okay. So on the 26, where did you get the numbers off at?
I added 26, okay. You know, all of those individually that you saw down to 45. And I did it 3 times, and I came up with 283. And so my question maybe was there someone who wasn't, or did you see 10 people who weren't for federal benefits?
It might have been in the Vietnam era, I would say.
All right. So I...
Because that number's a little bit too perfect, and you'll see later on why that number is too perfect.
Okay.
26, World War II, 24, Korea, 133 then for Vietnam. 19 Persian Gulf veterans, 31 during Cold War, or we consider that peacetime, 15 Iraq and Afghanistan, 45 surviving spouses, and then 40 we enrolled in VA health care. And that's an important area that even the VA has told me to work on, that our numbers are down in veterans. You know, how can we increase veterans that enroll in VA health care? Well, one way we could increase it is if we build a CBOC in Ames, Iowa, we would get more veterans. It just takes time to leave work and go down to your appointments. So that's probably some of the issues there. And during the quarter, did quite a bit of outreach, working with veterans and surviving spouses in nursing homes. And I do that weekly. Also assisted living, as well as working in our Story County jails. The next part here, talking about trips, but I want to take you back. January, we had a Veterans Day at the Capitol, and I took a dozen or so veterans down there. Pat, you might have been with us then.
Yes.
And I know all of our legislators were busy. We just couldn't find them to talk to them because they were busy in meetings and stuff. And so one guy says, hey, let's go see the Iowa Veterans Cemetery and the Gold Star Museum since we're down. Okay. So we went and did that, and it was a pretty neat educational trip. So anyway, we decided that July 12th we did a trip for 14 veterans, and we did just that. We went to the Gold Star Museum. And if you haven't been there, I mean, it's free. It's one of the best-kept secrets in Iowa, this place. And we've seen a Korea veteran was our tour guide, and must have been a history teacher or something, but he really knew everything about that Iowa Veterans Museum, the Gold Star Museum. So we took 14 down there in July, and then we turned around and we did 10 in September. I believe all of our commissioners were on during those trips. Also for outreach, we did a booth at the Iowa Work Job Fair in Ames, September 27th. We had a booth there. Seen quite a few veterans there. Actually seen 3 female veterans, told them about our opening for county commissioner. So hopefully you've been getting some apps on that. Training during the quarter. I was asked to go up and give training to the Hardin County VA director up there, Bernie. He's retired. He's a retired UNI professor. So I went up there and spent a little bit of time with him, and Because a lot of times in the county, when they're just one person, they walk out and the other one walks in, and then where do you go from there? So, and then also we had pension training August 23rd down at the Neil Smith Federal Building. We had a VA had a mental health summit August 24th, and they have those every year. And then last week, Aaron and I were there for 3 days for the service officers training, and the commissioners there for the first day. Meetings out and around the county, American Legion Post and the county American Legion meeting. Been attending those. Actually, the last county meeting we had, three commissioners out of four that were there. So we're pretty proactive being out in those organizations, as well as the Iowa Veterans Council, Iowa VA Commission meetings, and then also the County Vietnam Veterans of America meeting. To let you know, we started a council about 3 years ago. I'm not a Vietnam veteran. I got started, turned it over to this group, and John Cost and his officers have been taking care of that ever since. Some upcoming events. Got a newsletter going out in November. It's all done. It's just with our printers. We have 2,943 that's going to go out in with U.S. mail. We have 699 emails. Been trying to maybe send some of the paper mail ones over to email. And then we got 100 that we just have in our office. And also those will be sent out to the service organizations. So each American Legion, VBA, and VFW commanders have those.
Brett, I don't think I got the last one via email when I was...
No?
Yeah, it got dropped off. I'd be happy to receive an email copy.
An email copy.
If that works. Although I know Marty likes papers, so maybe if you're running over anyway with them.
But. Let me write that down, and I'll make sure and send you one. And then also we put it on our website.
Yeah.
Too, but I can. I'll email a copy. I'll just send it out to all elected officials. How about that?
That works.
And departments, in case we have any veterans in there. Okay.
With a nice tight little email or newsletter that you do.
Alrighty. November 7th. I brought some flyers. November 17th is our annual supermarket of veterans benefits. We've been doing this probably about 15 years now, and 1 year we ended up at the Moose Lodge and seen 151, and so we stopped right there. It's the Friday after Veterans Day, and the coffee bed is free.
It's a good event.
So we're having that November the 21st. I'm giving a presentation on post-traumatic stress disorder at the Ames Library at 7 p.m. if anybody's interested. We're going to have, I'm bringing along another guy that's from Puppy Jake. And we're going to have one of their puppies there that helps out with post-traumatic. Mm-hmm. It's the diagnosis is post-traumatic stress disorder. The VA is trying to get to calling it post-traumatic stress. So if you see PTS or PTSD, it means the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam books. During the quarter, 123 Vietnam books were issued. And I think at one in June when I had Dan Gannon here, the board had talked about spending $10 for each of those books.
I'm talking about replacing. Right. And so as I look at it, you say you got 451 books on hand. I think when you get down and
don't need it,
you don't need any right now, but when you do, I think the commitment we made is we would keep some on hand and we would buy.
Okay. And I, you know, what we did when we first started this, so June 1st, we opened the door for these books. And we did in-country Vietnam veterans, surviving spouses of in-country Vietnam veterans. We did that for about 100 days. Mm-hmm. And then we opened the door to Vietnam era. As we've seen the numbers going down, I think the first month, Pat, if I remember, is like 50. And then we just seen it going to 30, and then we've seen it going to 20, that like that. So then we opened the door and then raised the numbers back up.
True.
But one thing nice about this is every one of these, all 123, they got interviews. Exactly. Than just, here's your book, and oh, by the way, I brought one so you can see this, and we could pass this around. I always tell them, though, I mean, this is an Iowa edition, so the first part's about Iowa. Governor Terry Branstad, you'll see him in there, and some other people from Iowa, and then it gets into Vietnam, and for the in-country veterans, I always say, you know, enter with caution on those photos. I mean, they could just, a picture of something like that can just bring back some things for them. But I truly think the best part of the whole book is at the end. There's a CD back there, and it's about an hour long, and it's really neat. Now, the other thing I've done is put a book in each city library, and I'd like to put a book in maybe each school library, just so for some reason, if someday when we don't have any of these books or something, at least there'll be one there you can check out. I'm thinking about doing that. Dagan Blake, and this is where the pictures come in here. Let me bring up a picture. I know the board likes pictures. If I can just find it. Am I in the right area? Shit's gotta go over. This looks so much different than my computer. Yeah, just that. There's four of them. Oh, this one down. Yep. I don't know if you can see this right. There we are. It's kind of a. Can everybody see that? Okay. So let me give you the story here. We don't have a flag at Dakin's Lakes. We don't have an American flag out there flying anywhere. And a veteran brought that to our attention, basically, and Zaring.
Amazing that nobody recognized it. We built Dakin's Lake. We had it out there. Nobody recognized it. We didn't have an American flag out there until we had a veteran out. And he said, "Where's the American flag?"
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to have an American flag. So I'll give you some numbers here. So we're looking at a 30-foot pole. I know I took a picture of some air here, but if you see where that rock is and you see where that bush is, it's going to be in between there. And if you notice, I mean, this is back, this isn't at the road. This is back into the park a little bit. You'll see this little area. But anyway, so the flagpole is going to be $740 after rebate. Of a 5x8 nylon flag, $80. And floodlights, estimate around $300. Landscaping, $300. Total cost, $1,420. Conservation will likely need to purchase some additional materials to make the install happen, such as concrete to set the pole, which they'll just absorb out of their budget. So Danny Simcox and I have been working on this, huh?
So the $1,420 is coming out of your budget, correct?
No. I'll get to that. So I'm working with Danny Simcox on this. And so I went to the Vietnam Veterans of America chapter and said, "Hey, would you like to sponsor something?" And they said, "Yeah, they would. They would like to sponsor this, and that's where we're going to get the money from them." The only thing is, they said, "We want not just an American flag; we want a POW flag also underneath the American flag." So. They'll be doing that. Now, they may, that stone out there, or maybe one like it, they may etch Vietnam Veterans of America on that stone, is the only thing that they'd said. So.
My question has to do with who's going to handle the flag as far as for protocol when...
half staff.
Yes, half staff, rainstorms.
Well, Danny has a couple of veterans that live in Zaring who said that they would do that. Now, one idea, you know, they didn't put windmills up in that area because there wasn't any wind. One idea is in the wintertime, maybe not have anything flying there. I mean, you're going to wear out a flag from now through the winter. You know, we could have a flag there, but we'll end up replacing it, I'm sure, by spring. That doesn't go real well with veterans not having a flag there during that time, but so we'll just have to see. But Vietnam Veterans of America, we'll be looking at, you know, doing the replacement on those.
Okay.
Yeah.
And always we can look at in-house options, right?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know, conservation's going to need, I don't think they're going to need any extra funds for this project. There's just a picture of the, well, we're going to, that's where the conduit's going to come out for the power, hardwired in instead of doing solar. And then this is the other view, looking out. So you can see how far we are from the road, but I think you'll still be able to see a 30-foot pole from up there, from out there, you know. So almost directly behind that rock, but ahead of that that little bush there. And then there'll be more of those bushes put in. Have a little bit of a barrier there.
Nice.
And there's looking at the other way. Now, the reason for having it up there, if you see those trees in the back, those are going to get really, really tall. Those are oak trees, and they're going to get about 30 foot tall. So we can't. So that's why we got to have it on this side of those. So I think that's all I got on those photos. I just wanted to show you that.
Outstanding.
So we'll get that going. And I think that's I covered everything.
Yeah, we've got one seat open. We got a vacancy, but that's why it's good. We're up to five commissioners, so we got a vacancy, and we got four right now. We're working on getting that filled, and it's posted through the 1st of December.
November 27th.
Posted through November 27th, and then we'll see where we are on getting a replacement commissioner. Thank you.
Any
questions?
Sure. No, thank you.
Okay, one thing I want to add here, just something I kind of found out about, it's not a VA benefit or anything, but there was some operations, Operation Crossroads, 1946, Operation Wigwam, 1955. Remember some of those things?
No.
So anyway, there is $75,000 that a person may qualify for. And I've actually got this through, actually she was an employee, used to be an employee here, Peggy Kohler. And her dad died real young. And basically, if you were in one of these operations and you have a internal cancer or leukemia, or even if they're deceased in the family, the children could get this. And this is what we did for Peggy and her brothers and sisters. However, she had five to share this money with. But it take maybe about 3 months. So if you know anybody that served during one of these operations, and there's several, they want to just go ahead and get a hold of me, we'll go through and get the application, get it sent in, and
perfect
for a benefit of $75,000.
Brett, thank you. Pat, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go back up on the agenda one. Sober update by DuPont. John Pieper is here. So appreciate John coming. So I'll say this while John's getting settled in there. From the day it was announced that DuPont was coming to the area, they have really worked to be a good corporate citizen of our community. And, you know, we've had some delays on getting operational out there, and we've had some issues with store and fire, store and stover, which become store and fire in a couple areas. But DuPont's been really proactive and invested a lot of resources. And what's important for everybody to remember is we're the first place in the world that's trying to do anything like this. So everything we're experiencing with these Stover storage piles and as DuPont gets fully operational, everything they're going to experience. It's all brand new. Nobody's ever done it before. John came and presented, worked really closely with the Emergency Management Commission on the SCOBR issues, and came and presented Wednesday night, and I asked if he'd come and give a similar presentation to the board, just so that if Loris has any questions, she can ask them. And really appreciate you being here, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you accommodating my timing, too. I apologize for not being here at the start. Wanted to give just a quick update, as Rick said, I did last week on the current state of our fire management development. We look at fire management development in three stages. One, preventing fires. Secondly, responding well to those fires and confining them to the existing storage that where the fire started. And then thirdly, how do we minimize loss overall? And that's the big picture of loss. So today I'll give you a quick update on our current state and also on our current plan path forward. So when we look at prevention, I'll just remind you there's four areas where we believe fire can occur from in this material being stored: self-combustion, accidental ignition, malicious ignition, and lightning ignition. We've done a lot of work with Iowa State. We call self-combustion understood. Iowa State's tests across this material and a lot of different moisture levels has shown that there's just very little, and they say no risk of self-combustion. We do hold out one caveat. The reason there's no risk of self-combustion, in materials that do self-combust, you have free sugars available, and the bacteria eat on those sugars in the presence of sufficient heat, so less above 50 degrees, and moisture. And when they eat, they excrete acids, and the temperature rises to a combustible level. In this material, there are no free sugars, which is the nuance of cellulosic ethanol, is working from something that's not a sugar to create sugars and then ferment those. So since there's no sugars, there's no real food there for the bacteria to eat on, and our temperatures do rise as the material goes through its dry down, but to less than half of combustion ignition temperatures. What we watch out for is that we suspect that in a crop that does not progress naturally, especially during pollination, if we don't set kernels on the ear, that's where the sugars that are created by the plant end up sinking into starches in that kernel. If those kernels don't exist due to lack of pollination, we do know agronomically that the plant retains more sugar, more free sugar than normal. We don't have that very often in this part of the world. It's one of the things that makes this such a great place to produce corn. But we are watchful for a year or an area where that might occur so that we retest in those conditions to see if our risk changes there. The second is accidental, and accidental is a risk that we can prevent. Accidental would be caused by our own people causing that fire in the actions that we take. We have very little action in these storage sites now. We have good processes and limited access and good process controls when we're on site. We do recognize that we're going to be going very soon into a period of when we have more activity on these sites, because we will be de-inventorying to the plant as well as re-inventorying on an annual basis. And we're stepping up our overview of our on-site process controls to be sure that we're aware of that, and we continue to have a good record around accidental ignition. Lightning's been our bane, especially here in Story County. We've had five lightning fires in 4 years. And as in my last update, I updated that we were working with a lightning expert, a career expert in lightning from Florida. We've managed to somewhat stump him, but we have a great path forward for trying to understand more and more about lightning. But in the interim, we have taken the step to put lightning protection on 62% of our storage. So 25 of 40 pads of bales that we have stored now have lightning protection on them. That is mostly in Story County, because that's where the incidence of lightning fires has occurred. But we have left some pads unprotected in Story County as part of our go-forward tests. We want to be sure that the lightning protection that we put in place does work, and so we'll be monitoring the storms coming across and measuring the differential in lightning strikes where it's protected and where it's not, in that general area, not necessarily hitting a stack and causing a fire, but just are we holding lightning out of those areas. And then finally, malicious, and malicious or arson starting of fires is one that we've had good discussions around. The key thing about non-lightning ignition is timing. Lightning generally occurs in this area of the country, at least, with a great rainstorm, and that's been our experience, and during the growing season when everything's green. So we get some natural help in containing those fires. With other types of ignition, our timing can be any time. And so we did have an arson fire just north of Story County in August. It was unfortunate. We say that this one is definitely arson. It's the first in our formal storage, these large storage sites. There has been a person arrested and charged with that fire, as well as several other fires and other issues. In that case, a couple things we've done. Again, limiting access to our sites helps to do that. Having our sites monitored on a regular basis, but we can't monitor yet on a continuous basis, except for the Story County Sheriff's Department's Farm Watch program that we initiated with them. And it's been very beneficial in getting feedback. Once again, we got a reasonably quick response to this fire. It was in a very remote location. We got quick response, and then we looked at how did we respond to that. And again, that's in the second phase here, is how are we responding. And this arson fire was one where our process for responding, make sure that the right emergency personnel are activated and responding along with us. And then we go out and start to communicate with the neighbors right in the immediate area. And although this started shortly after midnight, one Friday night, and we were making these rounds early Saturday morning, we contacted neighbors before they even realized there was a fire next to them. And we feel that's the way we want to be. We want to be proactive in helping them understand that we have an active fire, and helping us watch in case it would spread on us. So in that as well, we have moved forward with our camera system. Verizon, it's a Verizon system that they call active camera watch system. So it's on our South 40 storage, which is immediately south of our plant, right up the road here. And we had a test set of cameras there. We're moving forward to install a full set of cameras. They're infrared cameras. It's an intelligent video, they call it, where the video system itself watches for the signature of heat or a fire, in this case forest, and then sends an electronic alert. This might be a system that can be very helpful in helping us to respond quickly and get emergency personnel as well as ourselves on the site. I will bring up also, as well as our response, we have done a better job of trying to minimize the resources from the community that we call on to manage these fires. We contrasted on Wednesday night. Our very first fire happened to be an accidental fire caused on the property where the material was stored. It was a rather small fire. It was 2,200 bales in three small stacks. And we learned a lot from that fire, and it started us down the path of designing our response, as well as our storage siting and our storage design. But in that case, we had local fire personnel on the scene for about 2 weeks. A lot of pizzas, a lot of support. We were there as well. We watched it, and what we found now is that really the first 48 hours are critical. In that first 48 hours, we have an active fire burning fairly rapidly. And once we get through those first 48 hours, in the absence of high winds or weather conditions like that, it becomes more or less a campfire. It gets ashed over. It restricts the oxygen to the fire, and so you're just monitoring the continuing burn. And it takes about 3 weeks for it to mostly burn down. At that point, our emergency response folks, our fire chiefs, have usually declared it out, even though we may have some smoldering areas yet ongoing. But basically, they've said there's very little risk of spread. We don't need continual monitoring at that time. In this last fire, it actually was declared out in 3 weeks, and it was out. Partially, that's due to the condition of the material. It was really, really high-quality material. And partially due to our actions to understand how to stir these fires, to keep them burning readily and get them out as quick as possible without blowing up the fire and making it an additional risk. So in this last fire, then, our local fire departments were actually on the scene just a matter of hours. So we got good learning, good understanding of these fires. They came in, they assessed the situation, they understood what we were going to do to maintain ongoing watch 24/7 until it was declared out. And they were willing to release the fire site to us. So we didn't tax the local resources much. And that's a great improvement that we've made in our rapid response as far as our process for controlling them. Again, I mentioned the direct contact with the immediate community. And then also we've been working with the Iowa DNR to model the air quality impact. And we do know that, again, especially in the first 24 to 48 hours when we have this more rapid consumption of material, that we can have a local air quality impact. And we thank the Nevada Emergency Response and Story County folks for their Facebook page, which also helps us to alert folks in a broader area that there's an active fire and the possibility of air quality issues that they might have to deal with. And then we've been working very readily for several years, but very actively this past year with Oak Ridge National Labs. And we did some test burns up at Chicago in the Underwriters Laboratory buildings. This is a building, the main building we worked in. They'll build a two-story house in this structure and then light it on fire and measure how quickly it burns and what it takes to put it out. We surprised them with our tests. We did a couple small burn tests with 12 bales. We did a large burn test, which we're all happy was designed down from 400 bales to 76 bales to try to get an understanding, because we ended up with those 76 bales having one of the hottest fires that they've ever seen in that building, and having to do an emergency shutdown. We wanted to run the burn test for about 2 hours. We were able to run it for about 18 minutes before we realized we needed to start putting water on it to put it out. So one of the two key outcomes from those total burns, one from that 76 bale test, was that we were able to measure that it takes about, but slightly over, 1,000 gallon per bale on fire to put the fire out. So when you think about these fires, even a 300 bale fire at the edge of a field is 300,000 gallons, which is why, as the fire department say, we've gone for 100 years and have not been able to put these out. We just have to manage the burning. And certainly at our scale, that's a whole new level, but neither is achievable today. So that was good learning for us. The next thing that we learned was that this material is not what I would call exceptionally combustible as a startup. And we did a test with these 12 bale burns where we, at each layer of material, each bale, so every 3 foot of bale, we inserted a cement board to cut off the airflow, the channels. So instead of having individual stacks of bales, we had each layer as its own separate area. And we were unable to get an active fire in that 12-bale stack cut off that way. We then returned to Iowa State and then later back to Underwriters Lab again to do some additional tests to say, okay, so with an artificial barrier, we were able to contain it from starting into an active fire. Can we do that effectively in the bale stack itself? And we have come up with a design. We tested instead of every layer, every 3 layers, and then every 6 layers. And we found that we can break it at every 3 layers and drastically reduce the spread and the growth of that fire. So we've come up with a stack design that we are implementing as we inventory this year's harvest into our stacks, which breaks the stack at every third bale, so 9 foot again. Well, actually, we break it at 9 foot, 3 bales, and then 2 more bales, we break it again in 2 directions. And we believe that this will give us more time as a fire starts to respond and then possibly to be able to bring in new firefighting techniques on a smaller fire that will let us get it fully under control and prevent the loss of even an entire pad or an entire stack. And along with that, we were able to look at some new technology that's coming. It was a side to our test, but there is new technology coming in firefighting that has to do with using low-volume, high-pressure water to fight a fire rather than high-volume, low-pressure. And it's been very successful in a number of fires. it looked like it could have some application in these types of fires as well, so we'll go forward and continue to look at that. So, again, that all fits then into our minimizing our loss. We continue to improve upon our storage siting criteria. We aren't adding any storage locations. We don't need it anymore going forward. In fact, from this point forward, we expect to start reducing those. And so we're using our siting criteria in reverse to say what are the current storage sites that we should first abandon due to the fact that others have better siting, better protection, better isolation from other assets in the area. And then our storage layout, we're looking at again. So I talked about the stack design. We still feel that our storage layout is very good for containing fires with the isolation that we have from groups of stacks to other groups of stacks. But we also have those designed in a way that we're looking at a square grouping the stack layout to an elongated one. So just as an example, rather than having six shorter stacks side by side, so it's broad in two directions, would it be better to have three side by side that are longer, but might allow you to have access to all three stacks more effectively without having to get in the middle of the group? We have those already in our design. We're just watching for opportunities to understand which gives us the best advantage. And then we put in place a de-inventory plan that rather than going to a storage site and de-inventorying it pad by pad and site by site, we de-inventory from the center of each pad first. So effectively, we start to split our inventory from having a large single pad into two smallers with a separation because we've de-inventoried the center pad. Go around, reduce the risk of total loss, large size fire in every location before we come back and de-inventory the locations. And we think that'll be effective in helping to lower our overall loss risk as well, and should help us as we go forward. So finally, what is our path forward? We want to continue to look for science-based, data-driven decisions to minimize all loss. And when I say all loss, I don't mean just all loss of our material, but the risk of loss to the surrounding resources and assets that we neighbor to. So in preventing fires, we do believe we're at a position where we need to verify some of these pieces that we put in place, our lightning protection, that sort of thing, continue to improve upon where we can and maintain those that are working well. Under respond and confine, we believe we have a good response criteria, and we've been very successful in all cases of confining the fire to our own location. And I say, when I say the we, please understand this, I'm not talking just about DuPont. I'm talking about all of the great folks that we've had helping us from the city of Nevada, from the county of Story, and from surrounding counties in the state as well. All of our partners that have helped us to do this. It's not our work alone. But we have a good plan in place there. We need to maintain it and improve it as science allows us to improve that. And where we look forward to really starting now to attack minimizing losses, the first thing that's going to help us is getting this plant running here towards the end of the year as we come back out of our turnaround. We reduce our inventory in half, our average inventory exposure in half right away because our inventory goes from full to zero between each harvest. So we cut that down as we go. Secondly, our de-inventory plan is well. And then thirdly, we want to continue to run scientific tests on new technologies that's available to help us understand how to control and fight these fires and put them out sooner. So some really exciting news, or news at least that we're really excited about.
Well, so appreciate you being here, John, and taking us through it. Clearly a really thorough report. Of course, we'll get to if you have any questions or you want clarification. Before we do that, John, can you give us in thumbnail sketch what's going on at the plant as the ramp up comes along, what your expectations are at this point?
Sure. We have run a couple of what we call test batches of ethanol through the plant, and then we ended up getting crowded into what we call a turnaround, a shutdown, to prepare for winter. We identified several things that we need to do to be winterized against an Iowa winter, which caught us by surprise. Well, not all of us by surprise, but caught us in the plant by surprise a couple of years ago. We want to be sure we're protected from winter. We expect at the end of November to restart the plant and to actually be in a phase of really debugging. So beyond commissioning, but going into running and debugging and ramping up to the scale that we can run at this time. So we're excited about that, and that's some of the greatest news for us on the feedstock team as well, is that we'll start turning this inventory and working through it. Yeah.
Thanks. Laura, questions?
Thank you. You did a very thorough job. I'm impressed and pleased to hear the effort that DuPont is putting into this. I do get inquiries every once in a while, and when we still had smoldering from the last fire that went on for a long time, was contacted by one person in particular who continued to be concerned. And so to be able to respond to these people and say, look, they are looking at everything from how they put the first bale on the ground and which site that's at, all the way through what will be firefighting if they have to in the future. That's very reassuring. So I appreciate you taking the time to come and explain it and so that it's on the record for everyone.
Thank you, and feel free to give a holler if you have other questions at any time, or to direct questions directly to us if you'd like. We'd be happy.
Yeah. And so just a couple things out of that. So when John and I first met several years ago and started talking about this, nobody knew anything about sober fires. I mean, this was brand new. We didn't even know what we didn't know. And we our knowledge base has grown exponentially since then. Now there's still a lot more questions than there are answers, but it's not for lack of effort from DuPont. And we've also got to call out, you mentioned Oak Ridge Labs. They've had somebody on the ground run some of these tests, but Iowa State University has been an integral partner in doing these things and running some of these tests. And Iowa State University, Story County, and DuPont, in terms of sober ethanol production and everything that goes with it, we really are at the epicenter of everything that's happening. And I just want to underscore where I started. DuPont has really worked hard to be a good community member all the way through. A lot of unforeseen things. A lot of unforeseen things with getting the plant fully commissioned and operational, unforeseen situations with storing sober. But it hasn't been anything based on lack of effort of DuPont. And John, really appreciate you rearranging your schedule to come over today.
Glad to do that. Thanks again.
I do have one more question. Yeah. And the question that I get, that I've gotten from a couple people, is that do you reimburse Nevada? They tend to, I mean, they're the primary responder here. Okay. Is there some way that DuPont reimburses Nevada Public Safety for
so response? I don't want to work from memory to say whether or not we made any payments to Nevada. What I will say is this. I know that we have made a couple of contributions in a couple of different areas. We always ask the local responders, you know, if you want to make a request of us, we'd be happy to send that in. We understand that all of our supporters, Nevada, Story County, and other and local fire departments, have made investment and incurred costs with our fires. To the most part of this time, as we try to get the plant running, what we've seen as our job is really to entertain any direct requests that we get and to spend and invest in trying to move this forward and understand how to put them out. So I hope we haven't missed on submitting any requests and trying to get some response there. I will assure you, right now, I think we're paying our taxes, and we're hopeful to get up in a cash flow position where we can become more of a benefactor in the community as well.
And I'll just say this. Rick Reynolds, who's the fire chief for Nevada, has been really, really involved in every step of the way, including he was standing there at the fire over in Chicago where they had – this is a building that was built to have fires, and they had to shut it down in 18 minutes because it was a bigger fire than they expected. But Ray's been part of that every step of the way.
And actually, we've used Ray – again, I don't want – tell stories out, but we've asked him on occasion to come beyond Story County to just give us an oversight and an overview because, again, the knowledge resides in Story County and in the Nevada area because this is where most of it's happened and what's occurred. So,
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Super Bowl.
Yeah, it was I learned a lot and very reassured.
Well, I thought it was important that we hear it directly rather than you listening to the audio of the emergency management, and I like that everybody else got to hear the full report as well. All right, next item is a departmental report from Animal Control. Sue. I thought we had a rule that you had to bring show and tell.
Yeah, we're not. Yeah, but I were just talking about that. I should have. There happens to be a mini Australian Shepherd out there, and you know, so I was gonna. Maybe I should stop by Deb's office this week. And
Riley needs a friend. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Let her. Let him. Let her have a look. See.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm just going to kind of give you a few of the numbers that we have going. We've had 307 hours of volunteer work this quarter, and the volunteers are instrumental in helping us socialize the animals. They work with the ones who might have issues or behavior that needs to be changed. A lot of this comes from SHRAW, students helping rescue animals, but there's also parents who bring children in, supervise, and you know, supervise with the children. We have many people that just come on their own that want to come in and volunteer. So the hours will definitely rise because now that the students are back in session, the hours that they're spending are, we're seeing a lot more than we did. And since this is from July, August, and September, and they weren't around, our volunteer numbers will grow. But they're, yesterday we had three girls there, and they took every one of our 13 dogs out and took them to the path. And so everybody got a good walk. And so they're very instrumental in helping us have them become adoptable. Our cat adoptions were 60. Our cats euthanized. We're noticing a bigger problem now with FIV. We had five euthanized because of that. We had one FIP, which is probably the most dangerous of all of those. And we had an FELV. We had three euthanized. And so we used to be kind of the county where this wasn't. You didn't see this. We'd periodically test them, but we wouldn't come up with any positives. And now that we're taking, which I'll talk about later, so many animals over to Iowa State, they are testing them for us, and we're coming up with a lot of positives. So this is another reason that we need to bring the cat population in Story County down. And I'll also talk about that later.
So can you just, instead of using the abbreviations, can you just say what these diseases are?
Well, one of them is feline distemper. And one of them, the FIP is almost like it comes through the pancreas. So once, it's very hard to diagnose because they don't have a shot for it. They don't have anything else really. It's the veterinarian's best guess, I would say. They have a test they could run, but it's not foolproof. So they go by what the symptoms of the animal are. And the other one's the feline influenza virus. And that is also something that, again, people would vaccinate, especially their outdoor cats. A lot of these we wouldn't be seeing. And so we don't want any of them, and they're all coming our way. So we're going to set up more programs so that we can hopefully get some animals, more animals vaccinated. And I think this has become, most of the animals are coming from the rural area where these are from.
You said because more animals are going over to ISU, is that because of spay and neuter, or is that because they're coming in visibly showing signs?
No, it's because, and I was going to talk about that later on.
Okay.
If that's okay, I'll just wait for a second.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our calls for assistance were 3,091. At the present time, we have 174 cats in the shelter, 13 dogs, one ball python, one bearded dragon, two guinea pigs, three rabbits, for a total of 194 animals. So here's how this story goes. You adopt one cat out, you get three in. That's pretty much how it is.
Stop adopting them out.
Well, then set up a permanent facility for them to live. This is the highest number of animals we ever had, but I think people's living situations are changing, and I think the cost for keeping an animal, a lot of people don't realize that when they get an animal that there's more than food and water. We actually ask for a donation for some food that we have at the shelter, for people that come in that tell us I wouldn't be able to keep my pet if I couldn't do this. You know, but that's where I want to get these people in, and also get the vaccines done, get the rabies shot, which is required not only by our county ordinance, but the state code as well. We got our double line phone, and it's working very well. Most of the time, both lines are ringing. And so we've had a couple times where somebody says, I've been trying to call you, and it's like, really, both lines have been busy, you know. And we only have so many people that can answer the phone. So, but we do, we get called, we call everybody back. And our adoption numbers were lower than they normally are in the summer, but now things pick up. It's a pattern we go through every year. Summer, everybody thinks would be a good time to bring in a pet, but actually people are out doing all kinds of other things. And so they usually look to the fall and spring to want to adopt when they can get back outside house training and doing all these other things. The new contracts, and I want to thank IT for helping us, by the way, set up our phones. That was awesome. So they did a very good job helping us get that on the road. The new contracts for the cities have been finalized and are now being sent back for signatures so that these 28 agreements can be signed by the board chair and finalized and then filed by the county and state also. So we'll be having those done hopefully very soon. We've started an Amazon wish list. Okay, so me, I'm not the computer guru. Anybody in here that knows me already knows this. And so I have younger people work at the shelter that say, we need to do this. Let's sign up for this. And I'm always kind of, Well, we started an Amazon account. It has been the best thing ever. People go on there. They just donate to the shelter. We get boxes from Amazon now every day. It's like Christmas, you know. So lots of people are donating to this account. When we've been in especially in a bad position for cat food and stuff, we've been getting it in the mail. So it's wonderful. And I know a lot of other shelters use this. I didn't know that it would be this beneficial, but it has really helped. National Cat Day is Sunday, October 29th. We have actually been invited. We've been there before several times. But the West Ames Hy-Vee on Thursday of this week from 10 to 2, they're setting up something special for us to come out for. Any animal products that they have that are sold will be half price if the people give them to the shelter. So that's a really good deal. They're half price in things that will be donated to the shelter. So that is awesome. And they continue to be we look forward to seeing them. They're very nice people over there to work with. They're very accommodating. And we're very lucky that they've chosen us for these types of activities.
Can I stop you a minute?
Sure.
Here? Okay. So this is wonderful. I know where I will be at some point on Thursday. Okay. What avenues have we looked at to get this out, to make sure that people know this? Have we let the newspaper know? Have we...
Well, Heidi has got it out on their pages. We've got it on our shelter page. We haven't put it out there any further because usually, and it probably should be, but usually the people that come in are just randomly coming in, and those are the people that end up wanting to adopt and donate to the shelter. But, I mean, we still have ample time to get this on our county website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we could do.
Okay. Just something for thought going forward to coordinate with outreach, because how long have you known about this, for example?
Well, we didn't finalize the date till last week.
Okay. So, and I'm thinking once again, like KSI does that morning, on Friday mornings, where nonprofits can put a pitch in, for something like that. Also thinking about, I think Leanne just did KHOI last week, maybe. So it's a thought as we move forward, is to see how, if we can get that information to outreach, then outreach can get it out. And, you know, because I often will see something on a Facebook page I don't follow, but I'll see it from another media source, and I will go and make a donation.
Okay.
Thank you.
This fall, the ISU Vet College has done many, many dog and cat spays and neuters for us. It has saved our budget a lot of money. They are spay and neutering cats and dogs for no charge. They give them their shots. That's where a lot of this feline leukemia, you know, FIP and everything testing has come from. So they're doing a wonderful job. They've even repaired some abscesses and things like that on the animals. So this, with my food bill for the other stuff that's in the shelter, it's kind of been, you know, keeping itself even. And like I said, they are the first, we are their go-to shelter. I think they do, I want to say they have an agreement with 29 shelters now, one in Minnesota even. But if they need stuff, they call us first, which is awesome. And we are in our trucking over there. So that's why we're finding out more about these animals that have this. This is not something we normally do because we've not had that problem. And what we do is when somebody adopts from us, we give them a certificate for a free physical exam. And then they go to the vet and we tell them, you know, if it is positive, because it's not, it doesn't put us in a good position to, our adoption fees would have to be very high to cover this. This is kind of an expensive test. And so we tell them if you take it to the vet and there's something, you know, it comes up positive, then we would take care of euthanasia and, you know, you can get a refund or pick out another animal. So we try to make it so it's good for everybody. We've had a couple people say, heck, I don't have another cat, which if you don't have another cat around, as FIV or, you know, FELV, you can just keep it in your house. So not a big deal. We ask that you don't let them outside, of course, but that works out really well. We started the process of looking over the applications for our temporary position to fill the spot need from the middle of December until the end of March of next year. So hopefully we'll be getting some interviews together maybe next week so we can get this on the road and kind of know where we're sitting before. This is because the person is taking maternity leave. We'd like to be in a good shape to have this person there by the time baby comes. That'll be very helpful for us. We have one more meeting with the architect, which should be brief, and then the plans for the remodel of the shelter will be brought to the board for questions and everything. Mm-hmm. So we're very excited. I've been excited all along, but this is like getting really exciting because you're now seeing it on paper and you're beginning to visualize how things are going to change and how much more efficient and how much better it's going to be for the animals and the people who visit and even the employees. We've been working on the finalization of the Story County Ordinance 265, amending Chapter 45. We have many good changes and not as many gray areas. Gray areas is where the quagmire is a lot of times for us. So we think we've brought something very good. There were a multitude of people that helped put this together. And so thanks goes out to all those people for their opinions and their input. And I think we came up with a really good ordinance. We are still working on a date. The vets have also been very busy working on a date for hopefully November, but possibly we wouldn't do it in December, possibly January. And what we would like to do is just have the spay-neuter clinic at our shelter. And, you know, people would bring the animals there in the morning. We would take them in, and they'd get done, and they could pick them up by a certain time in the afternoon. And, again, the vets are working on getting the free shots, the free rabies shots. They're going to give them their time. And there'll be a minimal cost, you know, involved. If for some reason somebody can't pay it, it's more worth it to us at this point to have that animal spay or neutered than it is worry about the minimal fee. Mm-hmm. So we would go forward and let them have that done. We've got to get this cat population down. So, and then we were also planning one for spring.
Super.
And then we're just busy. We've had calls after weekends, on weekends, and after hours. And I've been doing this job, I think, for about 24 years, and we've never had a busier year. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would have sworn the population of Story County rose by 250,000, you know, in the last year, because it just seems like everything is just, you know, so busy. At that same point, we keep our adoption rate has maintained very high. We don't, the euthanized cats that we did, like I said, there were a total of 9. We don't count those as euthanasias as such because we're not choosing, they would not be put to sleep had they not been found to have this disease. And right now, even the rescues that take these kind of animals are packed full. So it's come down to more we have to protect the animals that are in the shelter. So that's all I have.
Good questions.
Coming back to the 3,091 calls, quarter was just a huge amount. Okay. Do you happen to, can you give me an idea about how many of those occurred out of the 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. time period?
Oh, I would say less than 5%.
Oh, okay. Yes. So it's not like you or Anna who are the two officers, actual
right.
officers responding, no. are constantly being called out at night or on weekends.
No, and calls for assistance mean when we receive a complaint or a concern that we actually go out and visit with the people. We will go to places and, tell somebody about the ordinance. People that call on the phone, they have questions. I mean, we have a lot of people call us on the phone that think, since we're at the animal shelter, they just got this new animal, and we know everything there is to know about training a dog. But, I mean, we get a lot of questions to the animal shelter, lots and lots of questions.
Okay.
And so, yeah, they are high, but a lot of them are by phone.
Great.
Okay,
thanks.
Thanks, Sue. Next is consideration of minutes from October 17th.
I would so move as presented.
Second, any notations?
None.
Olson.
Yes, aye.
Sanders, aye. Personnel actions as listed.
I would move as presented.
Second. Olson?
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Consent agenda. Laura, so let's pull number two, which is a contract between IT and GoDaddy.
Right.
Is there anything else?
Nothing.
Okay, motion for consent agenda?
I would move the consent agenda as presented with the exception of pulling item number two.
And I'll second that. Olson?
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Let's talk about number two. So we've got a contract here with GoDaddy for $749.97, which is pretty standard stuff. It's something we've done the last few years, I think, or every 2 years. The difference with this one is we've got a new credit card policy that it doesn't appear was followed here. Barbara?
Well, yes. The credit card policy does not allow us to pay internet transactions with a credit card, and that's unfortunately the only type of payment GoDaddy will accept.
Right, but we've got a process when we're outside that you would make I assume this is something you've known about. This didn't sneak up on us. But there's a process to come through the board and make a request a couple weeks ago where it could be approved by the board, and then you could use the credit card for this. And so the reason that I wanted to pull it and let's talk about it is we just need to follow our own processes to get this stuff done.
Sure, and that fell through the cracks this time. What this is the security certificate for our webmail, and it is for a three-year contract. You get a better deal that way. And, Loris, you kind of saw this weekend what happens when you don't have that certificate.
Can't get on the webmail.
Right.
Right. I understand the need and everything, and I also even understand the GoDaddy will only take a credit card because that's where I've had my accounts through in the last few years. I also was going to ask if we could pull it just to discuss that about how do we coordinate this. Because an approval beforehand was, I thought, what we had passed on our policy rather than charging. But
so that's what we thought we were doing. My apologies. When we put it, we forgot to say pull it from the consent agenda because it was actually a consent item that needed to be talked about.
Yeah, it needed to be talked about, but it needed to be talked about a couple of weeks ago where we could have the approval and then use the credit card after the fact instead of before the fact.
Okay.
And that's the whole deal.
I feel that if we could keep that in mind in the future, because there's no way that GoDaddy's going to set up an account for us to pay by a check. So just that pre-approval.
Yep, just a process issue.
Yep.
Laura, you want to make the motion?
I will make a motion that we approve this payment to GoDaddy and payment of the credit card on which it was charged.
And I'll second it with a reminder to all staff and elected officials that we do have a credit card policy and must follow it. Olson?
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Passes. Thank you, Barbara.
Which credit card should I use? We do have the...
Check with Noel. Noel will work with you on making sure we get the right one.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Public hearing item, second consideration of Ordinance 265, amending 45, which was just referred to by Sue McCaskey. And this is, like I said, second reading. Any comments, anything that we need to be thinking about it during second reading?
None.
Did we receive any comments?
No, I have not. We kind of went through last week, kind of, you know, what we were doing, and it was up on the board for people to see. I've not received any comments at all.
Yeah, so I don't see any reason for us to go all the way back through it, Morris, unless you do. And really well done last week.
Right, no, I think you did a great job. They're also with the press coverage, and I have received some comments, all positive, but I guess that's not surprising considering some of the contacts. Out there in the animal rescue.
Well, I've received comments and positive comments on our action, but the coverage that it received, and so I think a really, really good thing. So if there's nothing, I'm going to open the public hearing. I'm going to ask if there's anybody who would like to address Ordinance 265, which amends Chapter 45. And seeing no one moving to the microphone, we'll close the public hearing and turn to the board for action.
I would move second consideration of Ordinance Number 265, which amends Chapter 45, and set the third and final reading for October 31st.
Perfect. I'll second that. Discussion.
None.
Anything to add? Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. It passed the second reading, and we'll set third and final reading for next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Next public hearing item is second consideration of Ordinance 266, which is a processes ordinance. It's amending our processes for conditional use permit and variance applications for our subdivisions. Any comments that we received? Again, a really thorough presentation last week.
Right. We received no comments from the last meeting. The board did approve the processes ordinances on the 17th. With the exception of that one provision,
8702, which
encourages divisions that would plus a survey to follow natural resources, but it's probably something that we'll bring up in the future.
Good, yeah. I mean, so the intent here, and I think what's accomplished, is it just spells out very clearly for those that would be requesting something exactly the process they're going to have to follow, rather than this idea that you're going to follow it because we've always done it this way. Now it's actually written down somewhere.
Correct.
So with that, of course, unless you have any questions, I'll open public hearing and ask if there's anyone who would like to address Ordinance 266. And seeing no one moving to the microphone, I'll turn to the board for action.
I would move second consideration of Ordinance 266, the process is ordinance amendments for subdivision plats, conditional use permit, and variance applications, with the exception of the adjusting to natural boundaries, and set the final hearing, a third and final hearing, for October 31st.
And I'll second that. Further discussion. Gary, anything to add?
Nothing.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Passes. Second consideration and third and final will be next week. Super. Additional items, discussion consideration of the Fernald Work Program here.
Morning.
Morning.
This is something. Good morning. This is something that Amelia and I will tag team on. Through the various quarterly reports, we've provided some information about our activities in Fernald. We intend to just give you kind of a brief update and then really kind of talk to you today about really the main reason why we're here, which is to kind of talk about how we can help the citizens in Fernald with the stormwater and the flooding that has gone on there. Just a little background again. May 23 of this year, we assessed the needs of the citizens. We had a community meeting. Over 30 property owners showed up. Again, this is something that was on our work program. We heard comments regarding 911 signs that were missing, street signs that were missing, improvements to the road, primarily patching that needed to be done, issues with dilapidated buildings, primarily some of the dwellings that are on the south side of Richland, nuisances. I've got a property that's stacked some wood at one of the main intersections of Winchester and Richland, and we're working with him still on that. And then, of course, what we heard the most about was the stormwater and the flooding, which is really what we're here to talk about. Nevada Fire Department did do a practice burn for the property at 65636 Richland. There's some rubble there still after the burn process, and so Environmental Health has sent a letter to the property owner telling them about the need to clean that up, remove that. There's also another dwelling that actually caught on fire that Environmental Health sent a notice of violation to, which is right next to it, 65692. And then just overall, a lot of the comments that were raised at that meeting, we've addressed administratively, the 911 signs, the patching of the road. Some of these nuisance issues are still being addressed. But again, the predominant thing really is the flooding and the stormwater. We're going to show you some of the photos that we took shortly after the meeting. This is the wood that's stacked up on the southeast corner of the main intersection there. The concern is that it's obstructing the view. It's a four-way stop. This is one of the houses that the Nevada Fire Department burned. It's down to rubble that needs to be removed. This is the other one that caught on fire by itself. Again, Environmental Health is working with the property owner through the notice of violation process. This is information that we extracted from the property owners. Highlights for the most part where the stormwater drainage issues were. There was one property on the north side of Richland, north side of Elm. This is just adjacent to a pretty large farm field to the east. But most of the stormwater drainage and flooding concerns really occurred along the west side of Winchester Avenue, which is the east side of the railroad right of the way there, which is really a contributor to some of the stormwater. There's some low spots. The water does drain from the north to the south, and there's some low spots within that right-of-way that it's allowing the water to extend eastward to some of those dwellings along the west side of Winchester. And then, of course, there's some flooding along the both sides of Maple, and then primarily this property on the south side of Maple, east of Winchester. So this is just an aerial. It's actually two aerials. We've got the north end. This is that property on the north side. The primary issue there is the field is about 2 or 3 feet higher, and so it's getting a lot of water from the farm field. On the south side, again, we've got the railroad right-of-way, Midwestern Railroad. There's like a drainage channel, but again, there's some low spots that's allowing water to extend eastward. And then again, around the Maple Street area, Winchester Street on that south end, we've got some standing water too. Photos, this is on that south end. This is a couple of photos that were provided by a property owner. This is looking out, the driveway is actually right here. And then this is Winchester. And then another view. Again, there's a tile in there that was constructed in 1920. After this meeting, we met with Darren, County Engineer, Director of External Operations, County Services, to kind of learn more about the tiling system. We learned that it was designed for a 1/8-inch rainfall event over a 24-hour period, which is okay for small rain events, but doesn't really do much for the larger rainfall activities. And so the tile is, it drains, but it backs up the water. So through that meeting, it was suggested by the county engineer that, that the area be studied, that the tile system be studied. And this just kind of shows you the existing tile system is a tile that extends through Winchester, north-south, extends southerly. As it extends southerly, the size of the line increases. It starts at about an 8-inch line in the village area, and then on the south end, down by 210th, it's like a 20-inch tile. So again, it works, but it's not removing the water quick enough on the heavier rainfall events. So another thing that we did is we met with a representative from the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship. We also met with the citizens again, did a walkthrough from the north to the south end, And their primary thing is they help with assistance with green practices, primarily non-piping. And they thought that really their practices wouldn't be that effective because of the volume of water. And these systems that they propose, the bioswales, rain gardens, they have to be maintained. You have to be on those all the time, or, you know, take care of them. We are going to be meeting again with NRCS staff November 2 to kind of look at the adjacent agricultural fields to see if maybe something can be proposed through like a CRP program maybe for some of the acres. So we're going to do that. We also met with the county attorney's staff and the county auditor's staff to try to talk about funding. You know, we don't always just bring problems to the board. We try to bring some options on how to address the issues. Lisa with the county auditor's office basically suggested that we, you know, that we not use county funds, that we use, you know, something other than special assessment, or that we not use county funds, that we use other resources.
Yeah, so the line there is using county funds to improve a drainage district is not allowed by law. That said, there's a gray area here because these are county roads, right? When for all the unincorporated, the roads became county roads, and we do have the opportunity to work on drainage along our county roads without it being part of a drainage district. And so that's the gray area, at least 100% right, but there's more to the story than just we can't.
Right. And then Ethan suggested that any grant or loan that we that be applied, that it be through the drainage district trustees and not the board of supervisors.
I have a question about that, and it has to do with are the trustees considered a community entity when we get further into possible programs? So wherever you want to address, if you want to come into that, that's fine.
Sure. So I reached out to the USDA about that, you know. Because we had that question too, and their response was basically, is that the person that typically has the authority to make those types of applications for the county? And so I forward that on to Ethan. So we're thinking about that as well. Yes, but if it is typically the board that has authority to act on these type of things as for the county or for the community, then yes, I think it would be okay. So, yeah. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the external funding sources that we've thought about for some of these stormwater and flooding issues. Again, like Rick said, county funds might not be appropriate other than, you know, the special assessment through the drainage district itself, but maybe federal funds could be applied for in this case, and there are several applicable programs that we've found. Again, after meeting with Darren, we realized we needed to do a study before any work can be done. In drainage districts, a study by an engineer is required for improvements over $50,000. But overall, we need a study to figure out what the problem is and what if there are any solutions. And so the USDA has a grant program called SEARCH, and it is for those kinds of studies in communities under $25,000 that are distressed. $2,500, I'm sorry. And so Fernald would qualify that for that, but there is a caveat, and that caveat is we need to do an income survey. We need to do an income survey because the USDA looks at the township level median household income data when it determines if an area qualifies as a distressed community. Richland Township has a pretty high median household income. You can request an income survey through the USDA, funded by the USDA, a nonprofit called the Midwest Assistance Program would complete that income survey. The request process is Board of Supervisors writes a letter, submits a letter to USDA detailing why we don't think that the median income of Richland Township matches what the median income
which I think is a fair premise.
Mm-hmm. We could look at different data like property values, those kinds of things to make that point. So that's the process there. if we were eligible for the search grant, the income survey would also help us apply for other USDA funds if we got to that point for the actual project and improvement work itself. We also looked at community development block grant funds for this kind of work. USDA seems to be a little bit more applicable in its focus on rural communities versus community development block grants. Might have a better chance if we were a larger community to get one of those. Those grants would also require an income survey, but the actual method to complete that survey is a little bit different than the USDA's method. So you could complete those at the same time, technically, but the methods are different. So that'd be two different surveys at once, essentially. And I've already talked a little bit about this income survey, but what we have to see, what I found out from USDA is about 43,000 is the level that Fernald would have to be at, median household income, to qualify for grants. And so these are kind of the next steps I wanted to lay out in what would happen if you guys motioned to have us pursue resources, including the income survey and this search grant. I think the next step, step two, would to be have another public meeting to talk to residents again about this and make sure they're on board with the income survey, explain the income survey, explain the subsequent study we would hope to do if the income survey determines that we were eligible. After that public meeting, we would then have the Board of Supervisors as Drainage District Trustees apply for that income survey. And then after that, steps four and five kind of depend on if it's determined if we're eligible or not, and the results of the study. So we did take this to our Planning and Zoning Commission in August for their meeting, and they supported us pursuing further resources and continuing to work on other issues, including looking at if land might be eligible for CRP, sending residents information on that, the adjacent farmland, as well as continuing to issue notices of violations as necessary and work on other nuisance and dilapidation issues in Fernald. So that's a similar motion we'd be looking for today. Take any questions about the programs or the process?
So just the timing, I'm concerned about us making the motion to pursue the income study before we have a conversation with people of Fernald again. It's pointless to pursue it if the people of Fernald are not interested in participating in that. The other one is, and we just need to talk to Ethan and Jessica some more about it, the other one is, I'm not convinced that the Drainage District trustees are eligible to do anything, applying for grants or anything else, and I think it's going to have to be a little dance between us and our role as Drainage District trustees and us and our role as Board of Supervisors. But I'm in general agreement. So Fernald doesn't, we are the representatives of Fernald, right? They don't have a city council. They're not incorporated, and too many times areas like a village like that, well, we see it. They get forgotten about, and you end up with issues that frankly, you shouldn't end up with.
Kind of piggybacking on that is that we're talking about Fernald, but I'm also thinking, you know, there may be one or two other areas then in the county down the road. So just I'm very interested in this process. I think you guys have done a great job of doing the research and looking for options. Impressed. A couple of these I've already seen through the Brenda Dreyer's knowledge about housing, okay? And so, but just really impressed with how thorough you have been in taking a look at this. So thank you for that. One of the questions then I have, I want to come all the way back to the enforcement of the situations we had with the dilapidated structures, et cetera. So could you give me an idea about where are we in that process? Have we actually served citations, or are we still trying to work with property owners?
On the practice burn one, I know that a letter went out by the Environmental Health Department this week.
Okay.
And then the other one, there was an NOV that was submitted. It was an issue that it caught on fire somehow, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure if she's
sent a second one. And usually you give applicants 30 days and then you follow up.
But we're at the beginning of that process.
Yes.
Okay. I do agree with Rick that I would flip the order and have another meeting with the residents, because we'll be asking them to provide some personal data that they may or may not want to provide, dependent, and unfortunately that may mean if they personally that on that lot they don't feel they have a problem, they may not want to participate where the house that has their own swimming pool sometimes in the front yard of the with the walking from the driveway. I can see they are very motivated to participate in it. So But I would like to see us then talk to the residents, and if the residents are interested and we can get that survey, then I'd like to see us pursue. It looks like a lot of this is in-house until the point where we're actually hiring experts. So that's fine.
Yeah. So, I'll second your commending our staff and what they put together to this point. But it seems to me there's five different areas of funding that we could utilize to improve, not just training, but to improve for now, right? Or any, talk about Iowa Center, talk about the possibility for Kelly down the road. There's lots of different areas. There's five different areas, right? The residents can donate money or improve stuff themselves. Kind of along those lines, the second one is drainage district, which is paid for by the property owners. I mean, the county would have a role in that based on our streets and the areas we own up there, but drainage district funds. You have grants, which we're talking about the possibility of getting in on grants. I believe there's the ability to use county funds not directly to improve drainage district, but if you're doing other things in the area, specifically road drainage, things like that, I believe there's an opportunity to use county funds. And then finally, along the lines of the county funds, I think there's an opportunity to utilize some conservation funds if there's programs and practices that can be put in place from a conservation perspective. I'm not saying any of those are any good. I'm saying I think those are the five areas that we could be looking at. But in my mind, it all starts with so our first conversation up there that Jerry led and Marty Chitty participated in and several others participated in was kind of what are your needs? Are you interested? We're here to listen. Now it seems to me the next step is follow up on that conversation. This is the work we've done. Go up and do a nice PowerPoint for it all. This is the work we've done. Here's the possibilities. But here's next steps to get to consideration of those possibilities. And then we move on from there.
Yeah, we'd like to do that probably within the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So you need a motion on that? Okay. I didn't know if there was Rick or did you want audience?
If anybody wants to weigh in to what's going on in Fernald and how you think the Board of Supervisors and ultimately county staff should be moving in this, now's a great time to come up and tell us. All right, seeing no one moving to the microphone, I believe the next step is, Lawrence, I believe the next step is general support with the concepts that are presented here, but set this next community meeting to have the full conversation, and then further action comes out of that meeting.
So I move that the board in basic principle in general is supportive of what is thankful for what has been done so far by staff, supportive of us moving into having a conversation and a presentation with the residents of Fernald, hopefully within the next couple of weeks. Staff instructed to set that, and then staff return to the board for further direction after that meeting is held.
Now, second. Further discussion. You think that's workable, Jerry?
I think it's very workable. Amelia?
Yep.
Yep. Well, great job.
Yeah.
Olson?
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Passes. We'll look for that meeting date. You wait too long, you're going to be bumping up against Thanksgiving.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Good advice.
This was well worth the little bit more time that it took to read through all of this. So yeah, thank you.
All right, so next is Timber Creek Acres, plat 1, 2, 3, and 4. We're going to deal with it all in one presentation, and then we'll take action if there is action individually on those four, if that's okay with you guys.
Perfect. Okay. We have four requests for residential parcel subdivisions today. The applicant is Dixon Jensen, who lives on Timber Creek Drive. This property is located in Section 23 of Washington Township. A little bit on the location, again, Washington Township, adjacent to the city of Ames on the western boundary, about 1,100 feet south of the Ames corporate limits along on the west side of Highway 69. So the surrounding land use, we have the Ames Municipal Airport to the west, Iowa State Research Park to the northwest there, and then along just north along Highway 69, there are several residential parcel subdivisions. I mean, I'm sorry, residential parcels, residential subdivisions inside the city of Ames. So the zoning and surrounding land use, this area is zoned A1. Outside of the corporate limits of the city of Ames, there are 19 parcels within a half mile of this property that have single-family dwellings. That includes the subject properties. Outside the corporate limits, there are 13 parcels that meet that 35-acre minimum for a single-family dwelling in the A1 district. And then, again, that's in a half within a half mile of the property. And then 1,100 feet north along Highway 69, there are lots. There are several subdivisions, lots between 1,200 and about square feet and about 1 acre. So the subject property, there are four single-family dwellings on this property. One is a farmstead along 69. 2, 3, and 4. The golf course was permitted through a conditional use permit in 2012. Looking at the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, this property is located with the Rural Service and Agricultural Conservation Area, specifically the Agriculture and Farm Service designation, and we'll get into some details on that. We do have some other natural area. The darker green designates the natural area located on the property. Again, these boundaries are not hard boundaries. They're really general, broad brushstrokes of boundaries on the properties. So looking at the specific designation for the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, the Rural Service and Agricultural Conservation Area has two land use designations. Currently, this property is designated Agriculture and Farm Service. Some of the policies in this designation are to preserve the farmland, limit non-agricultural residences to existing dwellings, and then farmsteads or homes on very large lots, typical of what we'd find across the county. Agriculture-related industry and commercial uses that would be dependent on its proximity to agriculture. And then subdivisions for new residential lots are not supported in this designation. The rural residential, on the other hand, the policies include single-family residential land uses with maximum average net densities of 1 unit per acre, encourage clustering of residential sites to limit short and long-term costs of infrastructure improvements, protecting natural resources, protecting the rural character, and buffering through buffering and appropriate land use transitions, and then limiting rural residential development on prime agricultural land, and also minimizing the impacts of that non-agricultural development on existing agricultural operations. So we're going to get into this more in a little bit, but we are recommending that the applicant request a change to this designation in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan.
Right.
So the background of these two pieces, these are original quarters, and each one of these was divided through a plat of survey in 1996. There is a private ingress-egress driveway easement here that was recorded in 1997. And then also each of these parcels does contain a single family dwelling, which is required for a residential subdivision process. The conditional use permit for the golf course, again, was approved in 2012. The dwellings were built in 96, 97, and 2000, and then again there's that existing farm set in 1952. So I'm going to get into now the plats. I'm going to go through them separately. Please let me know if you have any questions as we go along. The first plat 1 is on the very western side. Again, the City of Ames corporate limits is right here. So lot 1 would be kind of the C shape here, just to here. And it would include 29.29 acres and is the property that contains the property owner's dwelling. Lot 2 would be down in the southeastern corner here. Lot 2 would be 3.79 acres in size.
And just to clarify here, that Lot 1's driveway actually runs through Lot 2, correct?
Between, it runs on the north side of Lot 2.
So yeah.
See how it curved with the blue line?
Yes.
The driveway comes right here. Yep. So here's a kind of zoomed in image of the plat dwelling here. We do have a drainage easement designated on the plat here, and then again the Timber Creek Drive access easement there. So this is looking southwest from Timber Creek Drive, a proposed lot 2 that would be up here. This is Timber Creek Lane that extends south from Timber Creek Drive. This is looking southeast from Timber Creek Lane. I propose that too. The house would likely be located right in the center there. There are goats currently in these pictures on this property, but the applicant does use these at different development sites to keep down the weeds. So these are not always at the site. This is looking southeast at the dwelling on proposed lot 1. Looking east from the existing dwelling on proposed lot 1, Highway 69 would be way out there. Looking northeast from proposed lot 1, looking northeast, northeast toward from the dwelling toward the basketball court, located in this building here on proposed lot 1, and then looking north from proposed lot 1, and the airport is located right to the west here. Okay, the second plat under consideration contains lot 1, which has the existing single-family dwelling and would be 3.06 acres, and then proposed lot 2, which would be for a residential dwelling and contain 3.03 net acres. We did ask... Yeah. Do you have a question?
I was going to say, so that's right across the private drive from the proposed lot 2 on plat 1.
Yep, proposed, yep.
Right?
Proposed lot 2 is here.
And thank you for this visual in color, because I was taking the 4 plat drawings that you said, and somehow I didn't get one of them to line up,
there you go.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
Plat 2 is directly east of plat 1.
Thank you, yes, okay.
Yep. Okay, so we did ask where the proposed access point for this lot would be because of the natural resource area located here. We did ask for a note on the plat that said in order to preserve the natural area, access to lot 2 would be via access easement across lot 1. Probably it'll likely be right north of the natural area there. Here's an image of the plat. Again, we have the drainage easement, the 60-foot drainage easement that cuts through both lots there. This is looking northeast at the existing dwelling on proposed lot 1. Looking northeast from Timber Creek Drive at the western area of proposed lot 2. Likely the house would be in this open space here. Here's looking east at proposed lot 1. Proposed lot 1, proposed lot 2 would be kind of just north here. And then looking north across the eastern portion of lot 1 at proposed lot 2
Which is probably where you're talking about the access.
Correct, correct. Okay, looking at proposed plat 3, we have proposed, or the lot 1 would be about 18 acres, and this would contain the golf course. At this time, there is not a dwelling plan for this lot, although we did ask for a note on the plat saying that a modification to the existing conditional use permit for the golf course would be required prior to issuing a zoning permit for a single-family dwelling. So we have that. And then proposed lot 2 would be 1.37 acres and would contain the existing that farmstead, that dwelling there. Looking at the plat, again, the golf course and all of the structures that go along with the golf course would be all located on lot 1. So here's looking west at the golf structures on proposed lot 1. This is a training facility for the ISU men's and women's golf teams.
And probably the best in America, by the way. I just want to say that. Dixon, is that true, that that's the best training facility in America?
That's one,
Rick.
All right.
The greens were very green. These were taken in August.
Wow.
So this is looking south at the golf structures, and then also on proposed lot 1, and then also really hard to see, but back in here is the home located on proposed lot 2. This is looking north along Highway 69 from the access to the golf facility, and then looking south here, Timber Creek Drive is just to the south there. Looking northwest at the golf course on proposed lot 1. Looking southwest at the golf course, you can see a dwelling back in here. It's hard to see on the screen, but that would be the dwelling on plat 2. Okay. So looking north along, this is standing at the Timber Creek Drive access from Highway 69. So we're looking north along Highway 69 here, and then looking south. This is looking northwest at the dwelling on proposed lot 2.
That's the old farmstead.
Correct, yep. And then looking at the dwelling, you can see the golf course is immediately to the west of the dwelling, west and north. Okay, so the final residential parcel subdivision request is actually the one that the applicant is most interested in getting done as soon as possible. We have proposed lot 1 contains the existing single-family dwelling, and this is on the south side of Timber Creek Drive along, here's Highway 69. Lot 1 would be 8.43 acres, again, contain the existing dwelling. And then lot 2 would be 8.08 net acres and would be buildable for a single-family dwelling. Here's the plat here. There is a drainage easement boundary that follows kind of the curve of this pond here. So this is looking southwest at the dwelling on proposed lot 1 here. This is Timber Creek Drive. Oops, I'm sorry. Looking south, and this is looking southeast at proposed lot 2, Highway 69. Is there. So it's looking north. This would be the view looking north toward the golf course from Timber Creek Drive. And then looking southwest at the pond on proposed lot 1. So these requests are for residential parcel subdivision. So these are for residential purposes. Only two lots are created. You must have a single family dwelling or a farmstead on each parcel. They must be wholly within the A1 zoning district. Each lot must be at least 1 acre in size. And then we cannot permit any variances from subdivision or zoning standards through this process. So general comments from the interagency review team. I won't go through this. We did ask that Timber Creek Drive not be called a road and be called a driveway because it is a driveway easement. We had specific comments for each plat.
Environmental Health did request that applications for an NPDES permit for the sand filter discharge to the water body be submitted, and these were taken care of when we did receive copies of those applications. We did send notice letters to property owners within a quarter mile of these properties last week, and we did not receive any comments. As a courtesy, the proposed subdivisions were emailed to the City of Ames and the City of Gilbert back in August, and the Ames planning staff did raise some concerns about the consistency with the Ames Urban Fringe Plan designation.
But more based on subcategory.
Correct, the subcategory, exactly, yep. And the Ames planning staff does support an amendment to the map, and this item will be on the City Council's agenda this evening, actually. So, analysis, based on the current land use and comparison of the Ames Urban Fringe Plan policies for the rural residential designation, an Ames Urban Fringe Plan amendment is necessary to align with the existing and proposed site conditions. If approved, these resolutions for the subdivision requests would not be recorded until the land use framework map amendment is complete. Within the rural residential designation, the current A1 agriculture and the A1 agricultural zoning, the applicant can only complete the proposed divisions before you today. A rezoning would be required in the future if any additional divisions were being proposed. So all requested plats meet the residential parcel subdivision requirements. Property under consideration is in close proximity to several residential subdivisions inside the City of Ames, as well as several dwellings outside of the city. All newly proposed lots will take access off of Timber Creek Drive, a private driveway easement, which is permitted through the residential parcel subdivision provisions. All lots meet the minimum lot size of 1 acre. The applicant plans to maintain ownership of all of the lots at this time, and there will be no land taken out of row crop production. So as a condition, planning and development staff recommend that due to the transformation of the land use of the applicant's properties, the applicant is strongly encouraged to request an amendment to the Ames Urban Fringe Plan Land Use Framework Map designation from the Rural Service and Agriculture Conservation Area subcategory Agriculture and Farm Service designation to the rural residential designation.
Which, in fact, is how it's being used as we sit here today anyway, right?
Correct.
I mean, it meets the rural residential. It doesn't meet the ag and farm service designation in its current use.
Yeah, we feel that it more closely aligns with the rural residential designation.
Yeah.
Again, only an amendment to the subcategory is necessary.
Right.
The applicant has already submitted the request to the City of Ames to begin this process. So we're moving forward on that. So in terms of alternatives, we do need 4 motions, one for each subdivision request. But in general, we're recommending approval with the condition that the Ames Urban Fringe Plan designation be amended prior to the recording of the subdivisions.
Super. Thanks. Questions? So we got a citizen who wants to comment for sure. Any questions for staff before we go to that, and then we'll get to the landowner.
I had one of the comments on page 12 of what was submitted in our packet. It's actually below when you talk about rural residential, and going back here, if you look at the analysis, item number 6. The applicant plans to maintain ownership of all the lots at this time. The applicant's a developer, so I'm thinking this subdivision is not just, I mean, you know, that there's going to be some fail down the road. So
I think but maybe so, but the applicant owns all of those.
I understand. So here's my comment or question. Why do we bother to ask, even? Why do we care when they could sell it in the future? And I say, applicant, I'm not picking on you, sorry. It's more as like we ask this every time. And really, why do we need to know?
Probably because we know that he owns the 80 acres, that he currently owns all the property, and I think a lot of this is to assist family members.
So Lawrence's question is, does it matter? Does it matter whether he plans on owning them or not?
Not with regard to our regulations.
Okay.
He could sell them.
Okay, thank you. That's really all I was asking. Yep. I'm done. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, good job. Laying it all out again. Thank you.
Right. I mean, you know, fairly interesting process to try to work through this, especially with this proximity to Ames. Okay, so I know we've got at least one public comment that we want to hear, and then Dixon will come to you. Ma'am, come on up and start by introducing yourself. Or sir, introduction and address, please.
Okay, James Stewart, 3847 550th Avenue, which is just K corner across 69 from the property.
Okay, thanks. Slide number 5. Slide number 5. Can you go back to that?
Sure.
Okay. So basically, right there.
Okay.
And just something that has kind of concerned us for a while. Now, whether it's the airport, when they did some work there, or when the division was built, there's more water now flowing across 69. It's actually flooded 69 a couple of times. Just right in there. And I grew up on the farm. I've been there forever. And we never used to have water to go across there like it did. It actually got so bad that it was flooding Ken Merrill Road. And so the city asked and they gave them an easement so they could put a berm along there to protect that. Again, that's, I'm not sure where the water's coming from. Nobody's ever been able to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
drainage ditch just north or just west of where you're talking about right here, right? So we're north of the property
there's a creek that runs right along through here and then through here. So there's drainage there. The other drainage is clear up here, goes up into the timberland up there. So where this extra water is coming from, how it's getting there, I don't know. So it was never a question I've never been able to get an answer to. Now, this may not pertain to this at all. Another thing around the same time, we noticed that the water quality of the creek deteriorated. So we have very little aquatic creatures there anymore. So I'm not sure. So it's just a couple of concerns that we've had. Uh-huh. You know, there's a lot more algae in the creek, a lot more nutrients in there going off the, or just not allowing for, you know, frogs and everything else that we used to have. So those are just some concerns I have. I've asked the questions, I've never gotten the comments.
Absolutely, and as I recall, sitting here looking at that, that is part of a county drainage district, but it's actually one of those districts, Loris, that more than 25% of it is encompassed by the city of Ames, so Ames has controlling interest of it. But it's a question that we can sure ask, what's going on along there.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, if there's more buildings going to be built there, are we making sure that...
What's happening with the water that's there? And I think with the ponding that the Jensens have there, I think it would be a great question to ask Dixon. So thank you.
Okay.
Could you give me just an idea? You said you've been there for a long time. As you've noticed the deterioration in the water quality from your perspective, and also then the reduction in the amount of aquatic-related wildlife, has that been since the construction has occurred?
Yeah,
down
again,
here?
I'm not sure. When did the airport extend their runway?
Oh, wow.
Was that about the same time, mid-90s?
Yeah.
Okay. There are several things that.
But when you're referring it to all this, you're talking about over the last 20, 25 years all this has happened.
Yeah. It's been recent.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
Relatively recent. For me, it's been recent.
Thank you.
Okay.
So with that, Dixon, I'll ask you and or Blake to come on up. And if you have any comments, great. Or if you have any questions for Dixon, the one I know for sure is talk to us about what you see as if these lots are approved as you develop. Talk to us about runoff, since that was the question we got.
Sure. Dixon Jensen, 4611 Mortenson Road is my office address. I live at 600 Timber Creek Drive in Story County. I think these guys did a terrific job of presenting everything to you guys, so I really don't have a whole lot more to say. Don't need to repeat it all. Your question as it relates to water runoff, the proposal is to build 4 residential homes. Each home would be on an area that's plus or minus 5 acres. Pretty insignificant amount of water runoff. As a result of that, we certainly have civil engineers that will do their study on where the water runs and what it should run and what the calculations are before and after. And we won't impact the drainage districts any more after than we did before.
Well, in fact, you try to retain as much water there on your property as you can, don't you? I mean, you've got those ponds built, and just the times that I've been out in the area, I've noticed you seem to do things to try to hold the water.
Well, certainly so. I mean, again, the exact calculations and flow, that's all engineered and done according to DNR rules and city and county and state rules, and we certainly plan to do that in the proper way that everybody's pleased.
And, Jerry, before anything is constructed, so if these lots are put in before anything's constructed, that's something we look at as well, right, as part of our analysis of what's proposed to be built.
As far as the zoning permit, that will be required to submit zoning permits. We'll do setback inspections.
Right, but what we've dealt with out there with Cameron Estates, we're a little more interested in runoff now than traditionally the county has been.
They have to show that they're going to meet the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual requirements, yeah. The SUDIS requirements, which they provided.
Absolutely.
Well, one of the things, Dixon, is that we're learning from, it appears, the Cameron Estate situation, that meeting the state standards may not always address every issue right now. So staff is actually looking at possibly some additional protections. That's on the road, though, as they work on that. So my question to you, please remember I'm not a developer, so I may not use the right language here, but how onerous would it be upon you to work with our planning and development department and have your civil engineer take a look at the drainage above maybe stormwater, or be able to take a look at if your property or the ISU practice facility is in fact contributing to now what is the water pooling, the problems that they've got there?
I mean, we certainly can do whatever you want to do. I mean, you're talking about a large, to do a full study, you're doing a large watershed study, and in South Ames, there's been what's called the Ken Merrill Road, all of the airport studies that have been done for probably 3 or 4 of them over the last 10 years.
Okay.
There's 3 large drainage basins that go into off the airport. 2 of them were never put in. One is I'm developing up the road from there about 43 acres. So if you go there today, there's a heavy amount of dirt being moved in that area. We'll be putting in about 570 residential units. We've studied it for about 3 years. So there's studies on top of studies that I certainly could be glad to
hand over to you or anybody else if they want to interpret all those. And this particular Kenmare Road, certainly none of the water on these properties we're talking about go to Kenmare Road. So I guarantee you that. Why there's an issue at Kenmare Road, I can't answer that answer. My guess is it's a localized drainage. Something's broken, a tile close to that area, because the actual water runoff to that spot is pretty minimal. It goes north or it goes south, just like was pointed out. There's a drainage basin to the south and there's drainage to the north up on that hilltop. It's pretty minimal, but apparently it's something is not draining properly.
Thank you for the offer, the information, first of all, and also the offer that if the staff would like to maybe come and look at some things for their own edification or to see that. I do want to say that in my entire time in covering your company, and I have always been impressed. And I want to thank you for being a member of the development community that works well with government staff and always tries to take care of our resources, whether they be brick and mortar or whether they be the environment. So thank you for that.
You bet. Thank you for that comment. And again, whatever we need, and these guys have been great to work with and understanding the issues, and I think we can produce a few nice more homes out there, and it's a great spot for them, and it's good for everybody.
Thank you. So the beauty about Dylan Dixon is you know that he's going to do things the right way and leave it better than he finds it, and we appreciate you working with us just to try to make sure that gets done. And when there's a concern by a property owner, we'll just try to figure out. So I'm coming away from this with your assertion that anything you do on these four lots is not going to negatively impact the areas that we're talking about right here in terms of what you did.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything further prediction?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Before individual actions, Loris,
yes.
You're prepared if you got more we need to talk about before we go there.
I don't, other than to the Stewarts, a conversation further with the staff with you guys would be in order for the future.
I'm going to take from this, I'm going to go dig into the drainage districts, and we're going to have a conversation about, because I think Dave Dixon underpinned it right. Clearly, something's not happening like it's supposed to be happening, and drainage district law very clearly says that we must maintain to original specifications, which would have been somewhere in the 1920s probably, that it was. So we'll dig into it, and we'll try to figure out what's going on in the area. Thank you very much.
All right. Are we ready here, Shelley?
All right. Start with
1845. I move that we approve Resolution 1845 for Tipper Creek Acres, Plat 1, with conditions as set forth in SUB 14-17. Oh, as the residential parcel subdivision plat.
And the condition is doing the subcategory. You don't need to do this for everyone. I just want to make sure it's
okay.
Did the subcategory change or initiating that process for the City of Ames?
Correct, yes.
And I'll second that. Further discussion on 1845? Olson?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. 1845 passes. Same thing on 1846.
I move approval of Resolution 1846, the residential partial subdivision plat. That is hard to say. Timber Creek Estates, Plat 2, with conditions as already described, as put forth in SUB 16-17.
Second. Further discussion.
Done.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye.
I move that we approve Resolution 1847, the residential partial subdivision plat, Timber Creek Acres, Plat 3, with conditions as put forth in SUB 15-17.
Second. Further discussion. Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye.
I move that we approve Resolution 18-48, the residential partial subdivision plat, Timber Creek Acres, Plat 4, with conditions as put forth in SUB 13-17.
Second. Further discussion?
None.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Blake and Dixon, thanks for bearing with us all the way through that.
And we will bring the amendment request to you next Tuesday.
before the city of Ames
tonight.
Council tonight, and again, just to start the process, you need a majority of the three to accept the application, and then the next step is it needs to be approved.
And generally, this is the one that Gilbert stayed out of, right?
I don't have a crystal ball, but it's Southeast Ames that possibly may not have interest.
Good. Good job. Thank you. Okay. No other reports. Public forum number two. It's an opportunity for members of the public to comment on items not on today's agenda or anything else you want to comment on. Come right up to the microphone. Anybody wishing to do so? Seeing no one moving to the microphone, liaison assignments.
Okay, last week on Thursday, there was a low-income forum in Ames, and I went to listen, and it was a panel made up from the Story County Housing Trust. Also, the city of Ames has a very experienced employee that has dealt with low-income housing and HUD programs for a long time. There was also Luke Jensen was there and talking about readaptive reuse, and then there was a member of the Board of Realtors. And the discussions, and then I did put in a couple of comments about the possibility of the county, but I said we are just at the very start of even talking about where we might play a role. And I think the takeaway from that is that there are some programs that are not well known out there. The Story County Housing Trust Fund is going to be an excellent avenue for us to address the needs of our truly low-income residents. So once again, kind of proud of us that in participating and helping to get that started with covering the cost also for the smaller communities in our area for the next 2 years. And there will be many more discussions by a variety of groups. And I received an invitation from the two people involved in development of real estate. Please come and have a conversation with us. So I will be doing that. Community and Family Resources broke ground, which basically was we all got to stand on the little shovels.
And you break ground before you have funding, that's not much of a ground.
Yeah, we're still working on that. It's a unique model moving forward, but it's up in Fort Dodge, and so it's needed, and we will continue to follow that moving forward. This week, there's a couple of things that I think are of interest and import. Story County Economic Development Group is meeting Thursday, and one of Senator Joni Ernst's staffers are coming to discuss the farm bill and the impact on Story County. That's going to be right here in the public, this room, on Thursday at 10 o'clock in the morning. So if someone is interested in that, members of the community.
Well, it's an open meeting.
Okay. Also, I'm meeting with the City of Ames Planning and Development Director on Thursday, if we finally set a time, to discuss some parameters about the housing needs assessment study, kind of a little bit of the logistics known so far, so that it can go before the council. It's been put off again now. November 14th is what we're looking at, but want to just make some discussion about what would be probably some of the expectations. I did reach out to Leanne Harder already, ask if Leanne had participated in the study in 98. She got here in 99, but she's already given some feedback. I copied Deb on that to figure out even where do we put that. Okay. excuse me. So we've got a HERDA board meeting this week. I will be attending by phone because of the Story County meeting being right after it. But I have had a couple of reach out from residents who want to talk to me about HERDA as we head into next year's funding. So I'll come back to the board and let you know how that goes in a week or so.
Super.
Thank you.
So for me, I had a community member ask the other day why I don't give liaison updates, and today was a perfect case in point. Since I'm the chair of the board, I get to build the agendas as I see fit, and so my update this week would have been John Pieper and the Stover, and instead of me doing it at the end of the meeting, just me, I tend to invite people to come give the full update to the board and work through it that way. But just in case anybody else had that question about how the logistics work and all that, if there's nothing else, I take a motion to adjourn before you...
Yeah, right. I so move we adjourn.
Second, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. We adjourn. We almost got it done in time, Laura.